This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Kia ora and welcome back to the Equal Agenda Podcast. I'm Mia.
I'm Charlie.
And today we have a special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Kia ora koutou, ko Matariki Roach tōku ingoa, I te taha tōku pāpa, he uri au no airangi, I te taha tōku māma, he uri au no Ngāti Raukawa. Ai, kia ora, I'm Matariki.
And what do you do in life?
Great question. I try my best, but I work for an organisation called Young Workers Resource Centre. So we go out into high schools, community groups, tertiary institutes, and teach young workers their rights, hopefully before they have an experience of exploitation. And then we also have a free help centre for anyone under 35 who is experiencing some kind of workplace issue, or maybe they just want to get some advice or some support.
That's really cool. How did you get into that?
The backstory is that I'm what I call myself a union nepo baby. So my parents... I'm proud of being this type of nepo baby.
Yeah.
My parents both worked in the union movement. When I was 19, I did get exploited, and it was not a fun experience. And I took a personal grievance, which is like the formal way to raise a complaint against your boss. And I won.
Wow.
Which was really, really cool. It was a really awful, long, strenuous, emotionally draining process, though. I then kind of found out about working for unions. And then when I moved to Kirikiriroa, I discovered Young Workers Resource Centre and was like, young people and workers. Workers' rights, my two favourite things.
Are they outside of Hamilton as well?
We travel across the country. We go up to Auckland, Northland, do an Otago trip, and have done gone out to Taranaki, frequently go Bay of Plenty as well for delivering the education. So much can be done online now. So if it's just a general advice type of situation, you can be wherever in Aotearoa and we can help you out. And if you need like in-person representation and you're not here in Kirikiriroa, we'll try and find a reliable advocate or someone to help you out as well. We kind of only really learn about our workers' rights once we've been exploited.
Mm. I reckon you get your first job and you just like have to suck up to whoever's in charge, just need money.
Absolutely, and we're so used to just accepting the breadcrumbs and being like, we'll take anything. Like, oh my god, I'm employed, I'll do anything.
Yeah.
It's like, actually, we have these things called minimum standards.
Yeah. And you're also like basically a child. So you're like, yeah, I'll do it.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And you're so used to being like, oh, the adult in the room must have my best interests in heart.
Yeah, and you don't know what's like right and wrong too when it's your first job. I don't read my contract when I signed it. Today we are going to be talking about colonisation, feminism from like a cross-cultural perspective. Feminism is quite like a Western...
It's a big white people thing.
I also guess it's like feminism is like, you know, trying to unpick the patriarchy, and the patriarchy is like inherently a colonial white Western concept as well.
When I was researching this, I found that there were four waves of feminism. Do you know what the first one was? Pop quiz.
Was the first wave the suffrage movement?
Yes. And New Zealand was the first country to give women the right to vote. With Kate Sheppard.
Although we were not the first country to have women in parliament. That was Finland. We didn't get a woman in parliament until, I think, and oh, fact check me here, it might have been 1929?
Do you know what the second wave is?
Was that the Second World War industrialization getting into work?
The internet calls it the social cultural equality, which was in like the 60s, 80s.
Oh, I'm wrong.
Challenging norms in family work, leading to the equal pay movement, abortion rights, Roe v. Wade in America was 1973. Mia, do you know what the third wave is?
Nah.
It is individuality and diversity in the 90s. Was more when things were kind of intersecting with being a woman of colour, gay, women were allowed to like express their sexuality. And the fourth one was, can anyone guess?
I do know this. I swear I learned this.
It was the Me Too movement, and what defined it was the use of social media from like the 2010s onwards.
Okay, so it's kind of what we're in now.
I would assume so, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like there's no breaks, it just rolls into each other, right?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I think we're also still fighting a lot of the issues that were attempted to fight in the second wave.
And I think we also refine it as well, right? Like we have this rough goal from a previous wave, and then we take it onto the next wave and refine it and kind of, you know, reshape it a little bit to the modern context or the modern needs.
I'm going to assume by your introduction that you are Māori.
Yes. Yeah.
As a Māori woman, what is like the intersectionality of feminism and Māori culture for you?
I'd just like to preface with the fact that I am white presenting, like I look white. So there are lots of, let's be real here. So there are lots of like struggles about being a Māori woman that I do not face. But I guess one of the big intersections for me is, I guess maybe not intersection, but maybe differences between like looking at feminism through a white lens or a Pākehā lens and looking at feminism through a manawahine, like Māori worldview, is like the collectivity that exists within te ao Māori and like the manaakitanga that I feel is often lacking in a Western perspective of feminism. So like if we're going back to like pre-colonization, right, like te ao Māori was, still is, was based on collectiveness, right, and everyone looking after each other. And the roles of men and women may not have been the same, but they were valued equally. Like everyone, wahine, tāne, takatāwi, everyone had a role to play, and no role was like worth more than the other role. Like they all needed to exist. And there was kind of a greater emphasis on looking after everyone. You know, like homelessness wasn't a thing. We didn't have what we consider to be like capitalism and the economic kind of situation, jobs that we have now. Unemployment also wasn't a thing. And I think one of the things that I kind of see as a big difference historically, particularly in that third wave of feminism, is kind of like with white feminism, like this pursuit of being the same as men, you know, like to have equality rather than equity, being like we want to be the same as men, whereas I feel like in te ao Māori it's very much more we are not the same as men, and why would we want to be the same as men, but we would like our work and the work that we do to be valued equally.
That's what we learn a lot in like cross-cultural psychology. Western culture and like feminism too, very, very individualistic. So like people are seeking to define themselves by personal traits and achievements rather than your connection with others and stuff. That's not as emphasised in, well, white culture and in feminism, really.
Yeah. Mm,
100%. Yeah. Which also like goes back to like if you compare to like traditional Māori family units, right? It's like we didn't have the good old nuclear 2.5 kids and two parents. Everyone in the whānau or in the community was responsible for raising children, and that work was shared. And tāne men did a lot more of the mahi in that respect as well.
I grew up with my mum, and she is as white as paper, as is her background. And so when I started learning about the Māori culture and like my whakapapa and all that, it was almost like shocking that like how close everyone was, like the idea of everyone was like in the same house, whereas in my house it was just my mum and my brother, and then you'd go like down the road or whatever to Nan and Pop.
Yeah, and it's also like, I don't know, I think from Pākehā perspective, almost like you're seen to be like, I guess, poor or broke if you do have grandparents or multi-generational housing, right? Whereas from not just a te ao Māori perspective, from many other cultural perspectives, like it's actually, you're richer to have multi-generations.
Yeah.
Like those are the people who are going to be looking after the younger members of the whānau. Those are the people who are going to be passing on all the knowledges about how to cook the best food or plant up that garden, you know. There's a richness in having more than just the parents and kids in a household. I have an example of like one time when I was in my like kind of early teenage years, and I really noticed like the difference in perspectives between like Pākehā feminism and Māori feminism, which was, do you guys remember 2014-ish, a really big kōrero in Aotearoa about how it was, there are air quotes happening now, sexist for women to not be able to do whai kōrero?
Yes.
Yeah.
I remember this because growing up with a white mum and everyone around me was really white, I then took that on and I was like, yeah, why can't women stand at the front?
Yeah, 100%. Has your perspective changed since learning?
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah, I'm educated now.
We love that. But yeah, I remember kind of feeling like it was like this really big kind of like feminist moment, everyone being like, it's so sexist, and that not sitting right with me and not having the words to kind of like verbalize it. So for anyone who also doesn't know how to verbalize that kind of uncomfiness, I think what that kōrero was white feminist values and perspectives being put on a Māori practice. I think it also goes back to that kōrero about not wanting to be the same as men, but still wanting to have each of our work valued equally. Because if you're going to say that wahine don't speak on the marae, then you're going to completely erase the mahi of karanga.
Mm.
If you have a good kaikōrero, if you've got a good speaker, they should be following what's said in the karanga. Like, that's tell of a skilled kaikōrero, is if they can listen to the karanga, they should be listening to the karanga and weaving what's said in the karanga into their whaikōrero. And, you know, the karanga is the first words, it is the first voice that's spoken, that's heard on during a porphyry. So, yeah, I just felt like it was this really weird time, because on one hand you have like fierce white feminists saying, oh, it's so wrong, it's so sexist for wahine to not be able to whai kōrero, but at the same time they're erasing the mahi and the kōrero that women do have on the marae.
Yeah, it plays into something I think we talked about we did an episode on religion and how a lot of white feminists come across as white saviors, and they only see a very narrow portion and think, oh my god, we have to save the woman. But it's completely fine.
Yeah, it goes back to being like, let's not put ourselves, like, if we don't have that perspective, if we don't have a Māori perspective, let's not try and put our white perspective onto, yeah.
It is funny though that they're like, well, why can't they do that when women literally started?
Literally.
One thing I really enjoyed learning about the Māori culture was how not white it was.
Yeah, funny that.
Yeah.
Who
like
would have thought?
Even just like genders in general, there's in like readings and stuff that I've done through uni, they don't make it a big thing that it's, oh yes, the woman went and did this or the man went and did this. It's just there were people there and they were just living.
Yeah, they were just living, vibing, being.
Yeah.
100%. And I think also like our reo, our language is a really good example of that, because like we don't have, you know, gendered pronouns. We just have ia for he, she, they. But what we do have though is collective pronouns. We want to know how many of you there are so we know how many to feed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And same with yours, hers, his. Those possessive pronouns are also gender neutral. I also had like a kaiako once tell me, and like I've heard very many different kōrero about the kupu wairua, which is like your spirit. This was when I was like real angry teenage feminist vibes. And so to like break down the kupu wairua, you have a wairua, like the two waters, and that you have a taha tāne, you've got like a masculine side or a masculine water, and a taha wahine, a feminine waters, and they both flow through you, and so you have to value them equally. They're naturally a part of you.
We've had another guest on and she was saying a similar thing. She was very spiritual, and the feminine and masculine energies she thinks is what people go by, rather than that's a man, that's a woman.
Vibes based.
We like to, again, like to put everything in, what's it called?
Categories.
Boxes. Categories, yeah. It's like we were learning about in Pacifica countries too, like we like to separate kids and like give them gendered toys. Girls play this way, boys do this thing. But in Pacifica countries, again, less of an emphasis on you're a girl, you're a boy, this is how you're going to grow up differently. Like, they're all kind of treated very similarly. Like, they wear the same clothes, do the same activities. Like, they don't get separated. And then I think, like, they naturally, this is generally speaking, but naturally they kind of grow into their roles. And then we were learning about in Samoa how some of the boys, they come to, like, some of the more feminine roles. And then so they become whawhawhine. Like, white people had to go and, again, categorize everything. And so then they categorize them as trans, and can't remember fully, but yeah. But we had to go and categorize them as trans, but it's like a completely different thing. Like again, how we say it's good because it helps some people understand their identity. But then also, like, even with like the whole LGBTQ like names and labels and everything, like we feel we have to go put those labels on everyone, you know?
Because I was thinking, like, in the rainbow community, it's like bleeding into the fact that us ourselves, we then have to be like, okay, we are this label and you are that label. And it's very hard to switch between. And if you do switch, like, for example, lesbians that then come out as bisexual, even within the gay community, it's like, well, how can you be gay? Like, you're a lesbian. How can you like a man?
Yeah.
And I also think that the self-labelling that's done within the community, because it's also like so that cishet or non-queer people can understand those labels as well, right?
Yeah.
And like, I think that's also like going back to what you're saying about whawhawhine, those labels were ascribed so that Pākehā or a Western or a white perspective could understand what was happening there,
exactly,
rather than coming from within and being like, actually, we can just be whawhawhine and that doesn't need to have any further labels attached to that.
Exactly. So Fafafine, is the English translation of that like trans or something?
Well, there isn't really an English translation of it. It's more...
So was it created for white people to understand it, or has it always been something?
It's always, but it's never been like a big deal. I don't think that there was a need for labels. I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure Fafafine was so white people could understand. It's something different, like, yeah, from studies done there and from on Fafafine, and they're just like, yeah, no, we don't feel we are trans.
Mm.
Why are we put in this box? You
right,
know?
Yeah.
I feel like the term Fafafine has existed for ages, but I think that debate about whether or not that makes you trans or not, that's a placing that white perspective of gender on top of it.
And that's just one example of how, again, we've had to, you know, put things in boxes and give things labels, because that's not something that we have in white culture. So for us to be able to understand it, we've had to go and put labels and draw parallels.
Yeah. Trying to put like a white lens on something that isn't white, so you can't understand it through that lens.
Yes. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say. Another thing I was going to say before my train of thought loses, like, I was thinking of this at the very start, but I was like, there's quite a lot of parallels between how we're talking about like the waves of feminism and it's ongoing, and it will be ongoing as long as, I don't know how long it'll be ongoing. But it's gonna be going on for a while. That's the same as Indigenous movements too. Like Indigenous, is racial equality? Racial equality, that's the word for it. Like that's gonna be an ongoing fight as long as we're living in these Western white patriarchal, you know, like the institutions made by white men to originally benefit white men. Like although a lot of things have changed, like laws and policy and socially, we've shifted a lot.
But there's still work to do.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
It's also like as many steps as we take, we also take double back.
Especially now at the moment. This whole conservatism thing.
Yeah. One of our like main themes this season has been the rise of conservatism.
Oh.
And that also seems to intersect with everything.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, especially like the whole really weird thing that I've been saying about like, you know, the rise of also like being a trad wife and how that is also like a goal of whiteness because that plays into that nuclear family of things. Right, but also like how it's such a privilege because it's like, oh cool, you live in a household where one person's income can look after the whole household and therefore the other person will be, who, you know, in all the TikToks it's definitely a woman, be at home making the bread from scratch and you know, making the jams from scratch and raising the kids and all of that, and it's like, ah, god, that's a privilege in itself, but it's also so cooked.
I think it's even the same with looking back at a whole lot of things we've discussed, like even like beauty standards, like for example, the beauty standard is to be hairless, no hair, or like really light hair, and so people who like have darker skin and stuff, who grow more hair, grow darker hair and stuff,
it all just comes back to everything has a white perspective on it.
100%. And it's also like a lot of my aunties growing up had chin hairs and little mustaches, and so I like grew up thinking that was really normal, and then it wasn't until I got to like high school and that prevailing like white beauty standard came about, and I was like, oh, that is not the beauty standard or the role modeling that I had growing up, but it's the one that I'm now being taught to worship, essentially. One, unfortunately not uncommon, but two, just like a historic thing of trying to fit into like white beauty standards, even in the feminist movement. Oh, I'm gonna blank on the name now. The Temperance Christian Women's Council, the organization that Kate Shepherd was a part of, that was a big part of the suffrage movement. If Maori women wanted to join the council, they had to essentially declare or like promise that they wouldn't get moko kauai.
Yes, I remember reading about that.
Really? Yeah. What was the reasoning behind that?
I don't know what the official reasoning was, but I always thought it was, you know, you had to look a certain way in order to be part of this movement.
Oh, so you had to look presentable, which is very silly for a feminist movement, is that you had to present a certain
appeal to men to be able to get them.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's right, but like back then they probably did have to appeal to men to get their voice across.
Yeah, because it's more of a Western thing, anything on your face. Because I remember growing up and there would be people with regular face tattoos, and my grandparents who are white Christian, they were like, and then I associated that, well, if you saw Māori men and they had the full face, I was like, ugh.
Mm.
Because that's what I was taught from my white grandparents.
Yeah.
Is that face tattoos were
Yeah. Any face tattoo, even if they had cultural significance.
I wonder, because tattoos aren't, I think just generally in white culture, tattoos are probably more frowned upon, eh?
I feel like the age that we're in now, it's like very common and chill. Mm. But yeah. I like, even when I was growing up, there was like, you know, like the 2000s, 2010s, even up to like mid 2010s, it was, oh, you won't get a job if you have tattoos.
Oh,
like,
you'll
look unprofessional. It's a form of,
it was kind of like a rebellious thing to get tattoos.
Yeah. Oh, even our parents' age.
Which is why I think so many people cover themselves in the most ridiculous tattoos.
Oh, I am definitely one of those. Yeah. Like, oh, I'm a little sad, let's go get a tattoo.
Pretty much.
One of the other things that I was thinking about a lot of is how, like, manaakitanga is such a big part of te ao Māori, caring for people, looking after people, ensuring, mm-hmm. like, you know, no one goes without food or housing. And that's in, like, direct conflict with, like, a lot of, like, Pākehā practices and cultures as well. But how manaakitanga or, like, that caring work is often also seen as women's work. So I think there's, like, this double devaluing of Māori women, of wahine Māori, who do that mahi manaaki, who do that work of looking after people.
Mm.
And I do see that a lot of the time, like, the work of, like, properly celebrating people or, you know, even we've just had Christmas. Like, I was thinking about, like, what Christmas would look like without women.
Mm, yeah.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
It would not be special.
Yeah. We've talked about that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly right. So I do see there's, like, this weird kind of thing that's happening where it's like, well, manaakitanga is such a big part of te ao Māori. Manaakitanga and the caring is also, like, seen as women's work. And so there's, like, this devaluing of that caring work. But then I also see, like, particularly in white feminism, almost, like, this pursuit or, like, this pursuit of running away from that as well, of being, like, going back to that thing about a lot of white feminism in the past that I've seen has been about, like, trying to, like, striving to be a man rather than striving for women's work to be equally valued.
I, when I was researching, found there was this type of feminism where women are kind of told to lean into being a man and doing the same work as a man, and in that way it's like, oh well, you're as equal because you're doing the same amount, and you're being seen as a man, you know, that's feminism.
It was like what we talked about in our conservatism episode too, how there was a type of feminism where women were saying, like, the trad housewife movement, that's, I don't want to say it's a movement, but like the trend, the trad housewife trend, that's like a form of feminism.
Because they're choosing to be in that role.
Well, it is like almost a rebellion against what we've seen in the past, which, or like kind of a more in the recent past, which is like drive to be the girl boss, you know? So I think it's like a response to that almost, where it's like we've seen one type of feminist be like this girl boss type thing, and it's like, oh, actually we can choose to stay at home. And then also, like, one of the things that's interesting though, I think, about like that girl boss type of mentality is, I guess, on the pedestal or like what you deem to see as like the big successful girl boss, I also like in that kind of scenario, you assume that she's probably outsourcing a lot of like the domestic labor. Who is doing that domestic labor and who's being outsourced and then probably lowly underpaid for it? Usually brown women.
That's a really good point. I had something in my mind and then it just like left.
So but basically there's a whole lot of interpretations of what people think feminism should look like. What one's right? Probably none of them. Probably
it's
all
kind
of them
of like
all of them, yeah.
Everyone's kind of trying to have their own individual view and idea of what feminism is.
I do think, like, regardless of how there are so many different perspectives on feminism, I think, or I hope, that we've kind of reached a point now with feminism where we realise that for someone to call themselves a feminist or feminism movement to be successful, we can't leave, like, it can't just be for white people, like white women. We need to make sure that we're not leaving any woman behind. Similarly, like, it's got to include trans women too. Like, we can't just stay in this, like, there isn't going to be a trickle-down effect. Like, if white women are the only ones that are able to, like, break the glass ceiling and be successful, sure, maybe in 60, 70 years we might see some progress for the rest of the people who fit into the group of women, but we can't rely on that. We must be working from the margins to the centre rather than from those who already have the most privilege getting even more privilege.
Which I think is kind of like the basis for the third wave, was that it was very white woman feminism. Like if you look at Kate Shepherd and how, I think it's so funny how she was a part of that Christian group and they were like, okay, you can join but you have to look like us and you have to talk like us and all that. I wonder
it? If
like, did she look at that and be like, well, we're just like feeding into what the men want? Like at that time, like what you said earlier, they would have had to appeal more to the men. But do you think like she recognized that? Have you talked to her lately?
You know what? No, I haven't. Funny that. I think yes and no. Like, I think our understanding of intersectionality, for example, definitely, but I don't know if that was necessarily on the radar back then in the same way. And I think it's also, it's difficult. It's really easy for us now in 2026 to be like, oh, like apply understanding and our kind of perspectives and our values of 2026 onto literally the 1800s.
Mm.
I personally don't know because I haven't been speaking to her recently.
Yeah, she won't pick up my calls.
Oh, really?
We tried to get her on, but...
Yeah, yeah. She was like, no, no, thank you.
It's probably because talk Christianity too much.
She's like, ooh, they would have joined the temperance movement. Yeah. No, thank you. But I also think so much struggles with being a woman, being with a Māori woman, being just like so many struggles currently happening. But I also think that there was aspects of life back then that were also a lot harder. And I imagine they were kind of more looking at what's directly in front of them right at this time. Yeah. That's also a common line in movements generally, is like looking at just what's in front of you right now rather than looking at a wider picture. And it's really hard to look at that wider picture when you're fighting a fight right in front of you right moment, right?
Mm.
I said right a lot then.
And also everyone was much more racist back then too. So
yeah, it was very normalised.
It's like, because when was this? When
1893.
It was only the 1870s when Māori had representation in Parliament.
Mm.
And voting, like, right to votes was based on land ownership. Screwed over Māori. Oh, screwed over Māori.
No, they were still screwed over for years and years and years.
I would argue we're still being screwed over.
Yes, yeah, exactly. I wonder if it was, like, because it was so normalised back then, like, it just wasn't...
Like, even on her radar?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or if it would have appeared like a more radical movement.
Mm. And we're aware that we're leaving people behind, or we're aware that we could go further and faster and it's not palatable, or it's not deemed achievable right now.
Which, that would be a Western thing.
Absolutely.
Always comes back to it.
Sure does.
Was there anything in specific you wanted to cover?
The only other note I really had was just pay equity, which happened in the second wave of feminism that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We got Equal Pay Acts and then we got pay equity, two different things. First one being being paid for the same jobs, and then second one being paid for work of equal value, being paid equally. And I think also what we definitely see in today's times is that those jobs that were you know, traditionally seen as like woman jobs that were and still are underpaid and undervalued are like tend to be done more by brown women, by Māori, Pacifica, migrant women. And so we're still seeing that continuation of the pay inequality that's happening and pay inequity. And also our government did just like completely ruin all of our pay equity laws recently, which is really great.
They got rid of hundreds of cases, eh?
33 claims, which was something like, oh, my number's going to be wrong here, like 300,000 workers.
Wow.
Yeah. And not, it doesn't just affect women as well. It's like any worker, regardless of gender, in a woman-dominated job or industry, they're all getting screwed over by it.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. And they've been fighting for decades, some of those cases, like claims have been worked on for years and years and years, and all of that work's just been undone.
Oh my god, do you think they like got told through a letter?
I don't even know if they got told.
Because that would be crazy to find out.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I just spent my life fighting for this, and here comes the bald white guy.
He needed to find some money for the budget.
Yeah.
Yeah, they just like really screwed a lot of people over.
Yeah.
Happy news. Nice. Just to like give you guys some good news.
To summarize, there are many different waves, types of feminism. A lot of it has come from the Western white perspective. So now we are trying to build up like women of color, women of different sexualities, migrants, etc.
Basically undo the patriarchy, which was done by white men.
And hopefully like making a future where no woman is left behind, right?
Join us next week for our last episode of the season, where we just yap pretty much and summarize everything we've talked about. Hope you remember. Bye.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.